It appears the Iowa legislature is on track to adjourn next week, a full month earlier than last year. How likely is that to happen? It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth in for Ben Kiefer. IPR State House correspondent Joyce Russell will join us to explain just how optimistic we should be that this year's legislative session is almost over. And it's Earth Day. Ralph Rosenberg of the Iowa Environmental Council comes on to explain what the day has achieved in 45 years of existence. That's all coming up after this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth in for Ben Kiefer. Today is a News Buzz edition of the program, and it is also Earth Day. First established in 1970, events are held worldwide on April 22nd every year to celebrate and support the protection of the environment. Ralph Rosenberg is the executive director of the Iowa Environmental Council, and he joins us now to discuss the day. Hi, Ralph.
Hi, Claire.
So to start, tell us a little bit about the origins of Earth Day.
Well, the origins of Earth Day was to bring attention to a long list of threats to our environment and natural resources and to try to leave a legacy for future generations. And what happened was that it evolved. And so in the 80s and 90s, instead of bringing attention, people started wanting to take action. Recently, it's evolved again. And there is to bring results. The Environmental Council is emphasizing the need to bring results with an added sense of urgency. Again, for the legacy, to leave a better legacy for clean water and clean energy and solid, safe natural resources. But there's an urgency now. And people have seen some progress in 46 years, but we do need to see awareness and action year-round. So the Earth Day helps bring attention, it help may bring some action, but we need to see results, and so we'll continue to push for these areas.
You know, you mentioned these three sort of phases, attention, action, results. In the course of those 46 years that we've had since Earth Day has been created, any notable events, any really standout examples of what the day can be?
Well, and the individual day can be three different things. And really, the individual day should stand for all three. The individual day could be taking personal action. So personal action could be whether you walk or bike or go buy a car with high gas mileage. An individual day could be working with your church to convince your church to put solar panels on. An individual day could be farmers looking to install solar panels on their ag operations. So an individual day can do that. But an individual day can also be and needs to be getting involved in large-scale policy changes, which is what the Iowa Environmental Council pushes for. We want people to expand upon what they do on a personal level to take a much more active role. And our council relies upon individuals. It relies upon people in Iowans to contact elected officials about their desire for clean energy and clean water. And the final thing, actually, this is also a campaign year. So whether it's today or this summer or this fall, every Iowan is going to have an opportunity to ask every candidate at the local, state, or national levels, what will you do for clean energy? What will we do to become a 100% renewable state? What will we do so that we don't have to have beach closures? What do we do so we can make dramatic change to reduce the number of impaired waters in Iowa? So people have a chance to do something today, but they'll also have something to do tomorrow and next week and next month and in the summer and in the fall.
Well, and I think that brings up this very interesting question of efficacy. You know, has Earth Day made a difference? Can one day of heightened awareness translate into sustained action?
You know, the question of whether one day makes heightened awareness has gone through my mind off and on for 46 years. It's better to bring attention because it does have an opportunity to impact our future generation. I think for younger people, school-age people, I think a single Earth Day is important to take one day out. But I also think that the institutions like the students are part of, like the schools or faith-based institutions, need to do more than just rely on one day. And some of them are. So they're putting in energy-efficient operations, they're putting in energy-efficient windows, they're putting solar panels on. So maybe it's a little different for different people.
So in the 46 years that we've at least said, okay, at least one day needs to be dedicated to this,
right.
We need to bring awareness to this, what environmental problems have improved? What are some success stories?
Well, some of the success stories is that we've put in place mechanisms to protect our clean water. But what we need to continue to do is have eternal vigilance. So we have this Federal Clean Water Act that was passed over 40 years ago. We continue to use that today in Iowa. Environmental groups and groups concerned about clean water continue to use the enforcement of the Federal Clean Water Act to make sure that pollution is not discharged or that we minimize any adverse impact from pollution discharge in the waters. And that across the country, the Federal Clean Water Act is an excellent example.
Iowa lawmakers getting ready to adjourn right now. How
would
you characterize this session as far as environmental successes and failures?
Well, to characterize this session as a success would be it would be premature. I was a former legislator, and I know things can happen in the next week. Things can happen in the last day. But right now, there's been minimal change. There's still opportunities for some progress on the solar energy side, but in terms of clean water, we need to have a significant investment of, let's say, $150 to $180 million a year. The Environmental Council and other groups have been pushing this kind of investment. We've identified the need in Iowa for drinking water and recreational waters to reach that amount of money. It also happens to be the amount of money raised by a 3-8 cent tax increase, which some people know is also referred to as the Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Fund, which individual Iowans still have an opportunity to tell their legislators, it's okay to raise my taxes because it's a 3-8 cent penny. And I don't know if that's going to pass, but that's the kind of level or scope of success we're going to have, because without that, we can't really call it a success, but there's always a chance something like this might surface and pass at the last minute. I do hope, when it comes to water quality, that individual Iowans use this as an opportunity to educate candidates and their elected officials on how much they care about clean water or clean energy. And the lasting impact of the session may not be its minimal efforts to get something actually achieved, but to put to motivate Iowans to even put more pressure on so that next year we can reach this kind of success of passing I will.
You've given a lot of calls to action in the last few minutes for people to take this type of message to heart beyond just today. So if you could, give one emphatic call to action to change a day-to-day behavior, what would you urge a layperson to do in their daily life to help the earth?
I think to share what they do. I think there are thousands, tens of thousands of Iowans who do things because of their concern over water or air or land. And it may be using cloth bags for grocery. It may be going to certain businesses because they sell certain types of environmentally green products. And one of the things individuals can do is tell their friends and neighbors and relatives of what they're doing. Just verbally passing around saying, this is what we're doing in our own home, or this is what we're doing, we just traded in our gas-guzzling car, or this is what we're doing with bikes, or we're working with city council to put in more bike paths. And I think people just sharing those stories is what they can do today. Because I think there's thousands of those stories across Iowa.
Ralph Rosenberg, Executive Director of the Iowa Environmental Council, thank you again for joining us.
Thanks, Claire. Whoa, oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. All things ain't what they used to be, oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury.
Lawmakers at the Iowa State House are barreling towards adjournment. Here to discuss what's left to be done before the session can wrap up is State House correspondent Joyce Russell. Hi, Joyce.
Hello, Claire.
So we were just talking about environmental legislation with Ralph Rosenberg. Water quality was supposed to be a big issue at the State House this year, but as of now, it looks unlikely that any funding for water quality initiatives will be approved. What happened?
Well, just to clarify, we shouldn't say that no money for water quality will be approved because, you know, there are some ongoing water quality programs. House Republicans estimate that at about $20 million a year. Mm. I haven't been able to nail down just whether they'll be in that same neighborhood for next year's budget of around $20 million. But you're right, for a significant long-term funding for serious water quality problems, that didn't happen. And it was just a matter of Republicans and Democrats just having a strong difference about how to pay for it.
What's the outlook for the future?
Well, you're right that it does not appear that they're going to be passing anything this year. And frankly, it's hard to imagine how this will be resolved. When it gets right down to it, Republicans had a couple of ideas out there for, you know, significant new funding, like overtime in the billions of dollars. But the Republican plans shifted money from one source to another and did not raise any new money, did not raise taxes or any kind of new revenue source. And so Democrats, you know, saw that as taking money away from education and infrastructure and all of those other things. And they wanted to raise a fraction of a penny of the sales tax, which was one of their approaches. And, I could say in an election year, they're not going to raise taxes. But frankly, there's going to be a Republican resistance to raising taxes. And so it really is hard to see how this is going to be resolved.
Mm. So a lot of the budgets are in flux right now. A plan to defund Planned Parenthood did pass the House. Is that likely to survive budget negotiations?
Well, this isn't the first time that a measure to defund Planned Parenthood has gotten tacked on to the Health and Human Services budget. That's the logical place for it. That's where family planning money gets approved. And, you know, on a very, very partisan vote, the Republicans added that to their Health and Human Services budget, debated in the House, Democrats unsuccessful in removing it. Now it's in the Senate. And in fact, the Health and Human Services budget is scheduled to be debated in the Senate today. They won't go along with that. They will amend that out of the bill, and then it'll end up in conference committee. And then it's, you know, same situation they've been in the past where it actually delayed adjournment. I think there's enough of an adjournment vibe, a motivation to adjournment, that they're not going to let it drag on too long. But that is one of the things that has to be resolved.
If it wasn't going to pass the Iowa Senate and they knew that, why did the House include it?
Well, abortion is a very important issue to many Republicans, and it took on added significance and added attention this year because the controversy over videotaping in a Planned Parenthood clinic, the anti-abortion activists alleging that Planned Parenthood was against federal law selling fetal remains. They were cleared of any illegal activity, but that just really blew up as a big issue in the Republican presidential race. And so state by state, I was reading recently there are maybe 20 states where similar legislation like this is coming up. And, you know, this is an election year. This is something that Republicans and Democrats can campaign on this fall.
You mentioned this adjournment vibe in the air. Last year, the session took until June to finish, but you're optimistic that this might close up shop before April is out.
I am optimistic, but I've learned over the years that you just really can't be sure. The governor was asked about that yesterday, and he made a good point. And it does look like they're going to finish next week. But he said, well, you know, they rent apartments in Des Moines for the session, and their rental arrangements end at the end of April. So that's another extra incentive. But it really does feel like they're on track to adjourn next week.
What's left to be done before that adjournment?
Well, finishing up the budget. There are a couple of sticking points there. In addition to the abortion issue, they're working on an agreement to provide oversight for the new Medicaid privatization plan, although that doesn't look like that's too much of a sticking point. And then just a couple of other bills, Republicans and Democrats taking different approaches on the Midwest Academy issue, boarding school for children, which was found to foster an abusive atmosphere. The differences there, they're disagreeing over what kind of leeway to give for religious institutions. So they're going to have to work out their differences there. The medical marijuana issue could still come up, maybe not as a standalone bill, but attached to a budget bill of some kind. It was interesting, the main critic of the medical marijuana bill in the House, who's really one of the reasons why it has not advanced, is Representative Clell Bodler, who's a Law and Order Republican, a former lawman. And this week, I happened to walk by them in the rotunda, and he was having a real heart-to-heart talk, at 20 minutes at least, with two of the women whom we've come to know who are the activists for medical marijuana, Marie LaFrance and Sally Gare, who were instrumental in getting the limited cannabis oil bill passed a couple of years ago for their epileptic children. Mm. So it's clear they're still at it. And when they passed the cannabis oil thing a couple of years ago, it literally happened in the middle of the night. It was literally one of the last things they did. And that's one reason why I'm not ruling that out.
Okay. Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent. Thank you again.
Okay. Thank you, Claire.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth in for Ben Kiefer. If you've been driving around Iowa in the last couple weeks, you may have seen more green than you'd expect for this time of year. Cover crops are starting to dot the Iowa landscape. Some studies say nearly 25% of farmers are using them in some form. Now, some Iowa experts say that percentage is a touch too high, but regardless of exact numbers, more cover crops are being used than ever before. Tim Smith is a conventional farmer near Eagle Grove who uses cover crops on 575 of his 800 acres, and he joins us now. Hi, Tim.
Hi.
How are you doing?
Real good, thank you.
Good. So if I drove past one of your fields today, what would I see? What's planted there?
Cereal rye cover crop, and it would be pretty green.
So what type of benefits did this cover crop provide for you?
Well, I think the main benefit that the reason I started was for water quality. One of the things that cereal rye cover crop does is help reduce the nitrate loads into our streams because it helps sequester nitrogen out of the soil rather than go down through the tile lines.
Mm. And how does it affect the crop itself, your usual crops?
Well, typically it's terminated a week or two before I plant my corn. And then with my soybeans, I can terminate it about the same time that I plant my soybeans. I guess my experience has been it's not affected my cash crop at all, but I think long-term it will benefit my cash crops.
And why is that?
Well, It keeps nutrients in the field, so those nutrients that are sequestered actually are stored as carbon or organic matter, and that's retained in the field. The other benefit is it protects my soils from soil erosion. The last 3 or 4 years, we've had intense rainfall, both in frequency and quantity. And without protecting my soil, I think long-term I'm going to have a detrimental effect by soil erosion.
Remind me, how long have you been planting cover crops?
Well, I first started in 2011. I got involved with the NRCS program. It's a Mississippi River Basin Initiative, and the goal of that program was to reduce nitrate and phosphorus loads to the Gulf of Mexico because there's a large hypoxia area there in the Gulf. But it also benefits the state of Iowa. There are some cities that use river water for their source of drinking water. And so anything we can do to reduce nitrates in the water, I think, is a benefit for everybody.
How much has it lowered nitrogen levels in the water coming out of your tiles?
Well, on my farm, through tile sampling we've done over the last 4 years, it's probably reduced it by 30 to 40%. I've also installed a wood chip bioreactor, which also helps reduce nitrate loads. But I think typically it's probably saved about 30 pounds per acre of nitrogen loss.
Mm-hmm.
And that's in the watershed that I'm in, the Boone River watershed in north central Iowa. I think 30 to 35 pounds of nitrates per acre is kind of a typical year-to-year loss. So the cereali cover crops mitigates most of that.
You mentioned this wood chip bioreactor. For those of our listeners who don't know, can you explain that?
Yes, it's a structure that's right alongside the stream, and the tile water that drains my field flows into it, and it flows through it. And the wood chips serve as a carbon source for bacteria, and those bacteria will actually denitrify the water that's flowing through it. And, for example, last year we took some samples during the month of May, and the inflow water was about 10 parts per million, and the outflow water was 5 parts per million, which is acceptable levels for nitrate loss.
Hmm. So you mentioned the way that it impacts your cash crops. You know, does it pencil out? Are you still making a profit on the acres you've planted with cover crops?
Well, I believe so. There's a cost to cover crops. I think farmers are learning better ways to seed them. I typically seed with an airplane, but this fall I plan on using a grain drill to save some costs on the application. I'm also going to raise some of my own cereal rye to seed myself. So I think I can lower the cost that way. There are state incentives to use to get farmers to try these practices, and I think that'll offset most farmers' expenses if they want to get started just to try the cover crops.
You know, you're taking a long-term view on this. Why do you use cover crops? Why do you think it's important to do so?
Well, the farm, my home farm was bought by my great-great uncle in 1881. That's 135 years ago, and I've lived on that farm about half of those years. You know, and we look down the road another 100 and some years, you know, protecting our soil from erosion is critical. Also, protecting our water is critical. You know, that issue is not going to go away until the problem is solved.
Okay.
I think farmers need to realize that.
Tim Smith farms 800 acres near Eagle Grove. Thank you again, Tim.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River. Stay with us after the break. We'll check in with resident host Ben Kiefer on his travails in Europe, hear more about Harriet Tubman's place on the $20 bill, and learn about how parenting techniques affect childhood obesity. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Claire Roth. You may have noticed in the last couple weeks a fair amount of guest hosting on this program. That's because resident host Ben Kiefer has been traveling in Europe with a group of Iowa Public Radio listeners, and he joins us now to tell us a little bit about it. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Claire. Hello from the Alps.
How are you doing there?
I'm in Iowa. I'm doing great. We've had several wonderful days traveling a very scenic parts of the Alps, Vienna, Innsbruck, Salzburg, many wonderful places. And I'm in a little mountain village at the moment as I speak with you.
So, of course, the news we've been following recently in Europe, the refugee crisis, aftermath of the attacks in Brussels. Any evidence of those stories in your travels?
Well, I'd anticipated it. Security at airports is very high, but they're operating normally, it seems. Incidentally, I also traveled after 9/11. Then you saw a very obvious presence of military in the airports with automatic weapons and so forth. This doesn't like that. Of course, very thorough security checks on baggage. I even got the sense that the security checks at the EU airports were more than those in the United States. It is worth noting, Claire, that the U.S. State Department has warned tourists about potential risks going on in Europe. And to quote the U.S. State Department, terrorist groups continue to plan near-term attacks throughout Europe, targeting sporting events, tourist sites, restaurants, and transportation. So these two major terrorist attacks, Claire, in Europe in the past 4 months, we had Paris in November, and then most recently Brussels, definitely an impact on tourism.
You mentioned you talked with your tour guide, Anna Maria Massimi. She said she believed tourism was down by nearly 20% in certain countries. And this is something she had to say to you.
Well, the tourist industry definitely has been affected, not as badly as it was after September 11, but definitely this has been also creating a lot of cancellation, I would say, and a lot of the hotels and tour companies have been recording some tremendous numbers of cancellations so far. And people are somehow, you know, fearing that any big European city can become a target for these ISIS people.
So a lot of fear in traveling to those big cities.
Yes, that's right. And I also spoke with the members. We had some cancellations from the IPR Alpine Tour, reflecting the cancellations that Anna Maria Massimi just mentioned there. So I asked them just straight out, did you consider canceling after you heard about the Brussels attacks?
We actually didn't. I think the most we said to each other was, what do you think about going after Brussels? But we really did never consider canceling the trip.
Why? I think others would have thought otherwise. Others, in fact, I think did cancel.
We don't want to live our lives that way. We had planned this trip. We were really looking forward to it. It's the first time we've ever done anything like this. And we wanted to come.
The odds are so high against it being us for whatever reason. So we did not. We never considered. We noted it and said, I wonder if other people are nervous, but we weren't.
But you only live once.
Right. No thoughts of canceling or putting it off?
It crossed my mind.
Yeah.
But decided, no, I'm going to go.
No, I felt like not coming would just be giving in to fear. And that's what they're hoping for, is fearful people.
But do you have some concerns?
When I'm in the cities and there's a lot of people, I keep my eyes open. I think we should eliminate the use of backpacks, actually.
That would be pretty hard when you're traveling through Europe.
Yeah, it would. We'd have to travel really light.
I was the first person to call in and say, are you still having this tour? Because I was definitely not going to come. Yeah. I have two children. My daughter said, think twice about it, Mom. My son said, go ahead and go. He said, it's probably not going to have anything happen right now, you know. So I had lots of thoughts, but I decided to go.
How did you make that decision?
I think maybe somewhere down the line it's going to be harder to come to Europe because of those terrorist attacks. I really think it might get worse, and so I thought I might as well do it now in case I can't travel sometime.
Wow, some variety of perspectives. Ultimately, clearly, people ended up going, but there were some people that opted out. Is that right?
Yeah, from what I understand, the numbers were higher. We have 14 people from Iowa. We have a few other people from part of the other country in our group here. But there were several other couples, I believe, who were originally signed up who decided this wasn't the best for them at this time.
Mm. The other big story in Europe right now, flood of refugees. Any experience with that while you've been there?
Not during this IPR tour, but I was in Germany a week before the tour, taking the opportunity to visit my in-laws in Germany. Very much evidence of that amongst everyday Germans. we have to remember Germany has absorbed over 1 million refugees over the past year. And Claire, just to put that into perspective, that would be as if the United States, of course, with a much greater population, were to take in 4 million refugees in the course of 1 year. Every German city has several new refugee camps, right down to the villages. They have refugee camps. These are areas they find a spot that they can do it in and put up a refugee facility with a high fence around to protect them. You cannot just walk into these camps because of security concerns. There have been attacks on the facilities for asylum seekers, particularly in the east of Germany. So you can imagine what it would be like to all of a sudden, within the course of a year, have several refugee camps pop up in Cedar Rapids or Dubuque or Des Moines. And now German politicians have been debating how to integrate them into German society in the long term. No one's saying these people are going back. Not everyone in Germany is in agreement with, this welcoming attitude toward refugees that was put forth by the German chancellor, Angela Merkel. It's also given rise to a German party that is anti-immigrant, the Alternative für Deutschland, the AfD party. So a lot of pressure here to slow it down. It has been slowing down in recent weeks due to a deal between the European Union and Turkey. One other thing, though, you can encounter these on the street, Claire. I encountered a group of refugees playing soccer right where my in-laws live in Leverkusen is the city. They were going to a soccer area to just get some exercise. Interestingly, though, they were escorted by two representatives of a German charity organization, but also two security personnel with this group of about 20 men due to, as I mentioned, that threat of anti-immigrant actions, a real mix of immigrants from Africa, from the Middle East. I spoke with refugees from Afghanistan, Iraq, and Morocco.
Wow. So you've been to Germany many times before. You've been to Europe many times before.
I lived, for those who don't know, I lived in Germany for 11 years. Yeah, my wife is German and all my children were born in Germany, right?
Yeah, and so, you know, clearly it's not possible to draw huge conclusions from one man's anecdotal experience, but do you feel a palpable change in the air, a change in mood?
Well, there's very much people who were, you know, in theory, welcoming to refugees. When it comes into your community, you really have to think about that hard. Certainly many are very tolerant and welcoming. People reaching out, really wanting these people not to become sort of just cordoned off to a part of a town or a village, but to integrate them fully into German society. So you see very much the pro-immigrant position, but also certainly those who wish that the doors had not been opened quite so wide by Angela Merkel to welcome these refugees.
Okay, Ben Kiefer, host of River to River, traveling in Europe currently. Thank you again for giving us an update.
Okay, bye.
Earlier this week, Secretary of the Treasury Jacob Lew announced that Harriet Tubman will be portrayed on the $20 bill, displacing Andrew Jackson to the back of that bill. Here to help understand the redesign is Larry Adams, curator at the Higgins Museum in Okoboji. Hi, Larry.
Hello, how are you?
Good, good. So we have Harriet Tubman on the front of this $20 bill. Have we ever had women on our currency before?
Yes, way back in the 1880s. We had Martha Washington on the front of a $1 silver certificate.
Wow. And that was the only time that we've had women?
No, another time Martha Washington and George Washington were on the back of a $1 educational silver certificate. They called it an educational note. That was a series they called because of the design on the note.
But we've never had a woman on the front of a classic bill that everyone would use.
No, we have not.
Have we ever had a person of color on our currency before?
Not that I'm not aware of.
But you say that Harriet Tubman has been on some stamps and some other...
Yes, she has. There's been two different stamps she was on back in two different times, and not recent, but there was one in 1978. And there were two. There was one other one too. But there were two different ones that she was on.
Okay. So tell us, how much of a overhaul is this? When was the last big shift in the design of our currency?
Well, that was back in 1996. Was one big change on the $100 notes. They started issuing the new $100 notes in 1996. Then they started in 1997 issuing a new design $50 note.
Okay.
And these had different designs in them with a larger portrait of the person featured and more different security features.
Some are worried that the revamping of this 20 will take more than a decade because the $10 bill is slated to be redesigned first. Why the wait?
Well, it takes a while for the engravers and people working at the Bureau of Engraving to work on this bill and to decide what's going to be on it. Actually, when they do design a bill, when they do all this work on a bill, there's three agencies involved. The Bureau of Engraving and Printing, they print the notes, also the Federal Reserve, and the Secret Service. They all get involved in this process.
Interesting. So it takes a while.
Yes. And it takes a long time to engrave the note and decide what they're all going to put in it. And it takes a long time.
You know, is it conceivable, you know, we'll hardly be using currency by that point?
Well, I've heard that. And a lot of our transactions today are online, by computer, by credit card, by debit card, Bitcoin. You know, there's so many checks. We still use checks, but not as much as we used to. I mean, but there's certainly going to be a lot of times we're all going to want cash. Although, believe it or not, there are a lot of our U.S. currency, about two-thirds of it circulates outside the United States now.
So in addition to just the change of the portrait, there are also going to be some changes in the security features. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, I don't know that that's all been announced yet. But there certainly will be changes, and it takes the Secret Service are the ones that really do the ones are the ones who will go after the counterfeiters. In fact, the Secret Service started 125 years ago last year, for the main purpose was going after counterfeiters long before they started protecting the presidents.
Interesting. Okay, well, Larry Adams, curator at the Higgins Museum in Okoboji, thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
With a children's obesity epidemic in the United States, parents reach for a variety of tools to encourage healthy habits in their children. Recently published research from a scientist at the Iowa State University may be able to help. Tom Schofield is an assistant professor of human development and family studies at ISU, and he just published a paper in Social Science and Medicine examining the link between parenting techniques and children's physical health. Tom joins us now. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thank you for having me on the show.
Absolutely. So tell us what you were trying to understand in this study.
Well, there'd been a lot of research showing associations between parenting behavior and physical health outcomes in children and adolescents, but none of it looked at change in parenting behavior or predicting child outcomes over time. So it wasn't really methodologically robust. And so what we were trying to do was ask the question in a more causally sophisticated way that would get closer to the kind of causal evidence people want to base policy on.
So how'd you go about examining that?
Well, we took a sample of children who had been video recorded as they interacted with their parents when the children were on average 13 years old. And then the parents had been rated based on their behavior towards the child. So it had the advantage of being actual observations of behavior from the parents. And then those children had been followed as they grew into adulthood. And so then we had multiple assessments of health outcomes over time, and we could ask just not whether these things were correlated with each other, as so many things often are. I mean, in the census, the color of your eyes and the number of lawnmowers you own is probably correlated. but we were able to ask more sophisticated questions that get closer to, is parenting behavior actually affecting these health outcomes?
And what did you find?
Well, what we found is that it appears to be that harshness is not a good thing for health, which is consistent with the previous literature. The effects are naturally smaller, which is what happens when you ask more rigorously. With a rigorous experimental design, usually effects attenuate some. What we also found was, though, and this was the first study to look at this, was that the behavior of the other parent also seems to matter and that they interact with each other, which if you're a child, I guess that would make sense, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So help us understand, what do you mean by harsh? How do you define that?
Well, in this study, we looked at harshness as a composite of parents who are hostile towards the child verbally, parents who behave in antisocial or kind of like angry, coercive ways during the interaction, and as a final component, parents who are aggressive physically towards the 13-year-old.
So were you studying harshness overall or harshness when it came to intending to impart habits?
Oh, we were in general, my research is on parenting harshness in general, harshness and positive parenting.
I see. So it had an effect even if it wasn't, you know, directly like yelling, eat your vegetables, for instance.
No, it was not related to any particular health outcomes. This was just a behavioral task asking about, how do you address these problems in your family? And when this comes up, what do you do? It was very much not a health-related discussion.
Interesting. And you brought up earlier, you also examined so-called good cop, bad cop parenting. Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, that was a clever turn of phrase by Angie Hunt in our in our department here, our communications department. The question we were asking was whether or not one parent, through warm, supportive, nurturing parenting, could potentially buffer whatever health risk comes from harshness from the other parent. And what we found was a story that suggests maybe if you're using the adolescent self-report of physical health, the answer is yes. But if you're looking at a more biologically based measure like body mass index, then actually the answer is no. That conflicting parent message of one parent being warm and the other parent being really harsh actually seems to be the worst outcome.
Quickly, before we have to go, what takeaways are there in this study for parents that want to impart healthy habits for their children?
The answer that I would give is not only do you want to be teaching healthy food habits and things that you would immediately associate with physical health, but just understand that the emotional climate you create for children gets under their skin in a lot of sophisticated biological ways that we're just uncovering. And that has just as much of an effect on their health, albeit a delayed effect, than teaching them to eat their vegetables.
Interesting. Tom Schofield, Assistant Professor of Human Development and Family Studies at ISU, thank you again for joining us.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Rock icon Prince died yesterday in his home in Minneapolis. He was 57. Fans have shown an outpouring of grief across the country, remembering the man who is credited with creating the Minneapolis sound, a mixture of funk, rock, pop, and new wave. Across social media, Iowa fans have been reminiscing on their experiences of seeing Prince perform live, including Tom Snee, who shared this memory with us.
I went to college in the Twin Cities in the mid-1980s and worked at my college radio station. And every once in a while, we would get a phone call in the middle of the afternoon saying, hey, Prince is going to be at First Avenue tonight to do a snap show. Tell everybody about it. And I always wanted to go, but I knew that I would never get in because by the time my shift was over and I was able to get to downtown Minneapolis, it was the line was going to be around the block and I was never going to be able to get in. That was kind of a disappointment. But about 10, 12 years later, I was living in the Quad Cities and he performed in Moline. It was another snap show. It was announced about, the day before the show. And the arena was only about half full because of that. And he was doing a lot of songs from some of his more recent albums at the time. This was 1997. And I hadn't heard a lot of the songs that he was playing, but even despite that going against him, the small house and the unfamiliar music, it was still one of the two or three, maybe four best shows I've ever seen in my life. He just blew everybody away. It was really incredible.
Those who attended the Super Bowl in 2007 got a taste of the Prince experience when he did the halftime show, performing Purple Rain in the pouring rain.
I never meant to cause you any sorrow. I never meant to cause you any pain. I only wanted one time to see you laughing, babe. Only wanna see you laughing, yeah. in the purple rain, purple rain, purple rain, purple rain, purple rain. That's all right. Come on, y'all. Purple rain, purple rain. Oh yes. Don't it feel good? Can I play this guitar?
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Emily Woodbury. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Claire Roth. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend.